I'm Tracy from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Are you a small business owner or even someone who dreams of entrepreneurship? Then check out season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from iHeart Podcasts and Intuit QuickBooks. Join hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres as they interview entrepreneurs sharing insights around starting and nurturing a small business. You won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too.
Planning your next trip? Choice Hotels' family of 22 brands has over 7,400 locations and the perfect hotel for any traveler you want to be. Like a Cambria Hotel, serving up locally inspired craft cocktails for all my folks who maybe want to meet up and talk about Mad Royals. Check into a Radisson Hotel with flexible workspaces for you strivers who listen during business travel. Or a Comfort Hotel with free hot breakfast, family-friendly pools, and big spacious rooms for the parents who listen with their kids and need a little retreat. What are you waiting for? Join Choice Privileges and start earning points toward your next stay. Find a stay for any you when you book direct at choicehotels.com, where travels come true.
Looking to part ways with complicated, expensive, and uncertain shipping? Then give your business the edge it needs with USPS Ground Advantage shipping from the United States Postal Service. Keep everything simple with clear upfront pricing and no unexpected surcharges. Keep things affordable with some of the lowest prices out there. And keep it all reliable with on-time ground shipments. It's time to turn shipping to your advantage. Learn how at usps.com/advantage. USPS Ground Advantage. Simple, affordable, reliable.
Welcome to Stuff You Missed in History Class, a production of iHeartRadio. Hello and welcome to the podcast. I'm Holly Fry.
And I'm Tracy V. Wilson.
Today we are going to talk about a person that came up in a recent episode, and I was like, we got to talk about this. And that is Vinnie Rehm. She came up in a recent episode about Charles Francis Hall. She was not directly involved in that story, but jealousy between two other men over her attention may have been a factor in Charles Francis Hall's death. That remains entirely a matter of speculation, but even without that episode happening in her life, which didn't really happen in her life, it happened elsewhere. Her life was really full of drama and excitement and achievement. Don't worry, we will touch on that possible love triangle in the episode. She had so much that went on before she was even, you know, an adult, essentially, like in her very early adult years, that like, she's a lot. She managed to reach a level with her art that very few people manage. She did so at a very early age. She became the first woman to be given an art commission by the U.S. government when she was still very young. And she was also at the center of a lot of controversy and scandal, and so much that we have to do her life in two parts. That first part is going to cover Rehm's early life and her turbulent rise to fame in Washington, D.C. And then part two will cover the completion of her first major work, that commission we just talked about, and the rest of her life. And if that sounds a little bit lopsided, as you'll see, it's because her first big commission caused a lot of conflict. And then not too much later in her life, she kind of went dark as an artist for a couple of decades.
So Lavinia Ellen Rehm was born September 25th, 1847, in Madison, Wisconsin. Her family was not especially wealthy. Her father, Robert L. Rehm, ran an inn at the time, and she was named after her mother, also named Lavinia. The younger Lavinia was nicknamed Vinnie, and that's the name that she went by through her whole life. Vinnie had two siblings. There was a brother named Robert Jr., who went by Bob, and a sister named Cynthia Ann, who went by Mary.
Yeah, she really went by Vinnie. Like, looking at documents and stuff that she prepares later in her life, she does not sign anything Lavinia. It's always Vinnie. And when Vinnie was still just a baby, her father, Robert, who had worked in a few roles in local politics, started a series of jobs as a surveyor for various government offices. He left innkeeping behind. And because of this new job, the family traveled around a lot. Basically, wherever Robert had to go to perform his work and create maps of the areas that he had surveyed, the whole family went. In addition to Wisconsin, as she grew up, Vinnie lived in Kansas, Iowa, Nebraska, Missouri, and Arkansas at various times. And eventually they ended up in Washington, D.C., where Robert Sr. was hired by the War Department as a cartographer during the Civil War. Bob, her older brother, who at this point was an adult, had stayed in Arkansas, but Mary and Vinny had traveled with their parents to Washington. And both of the girls got jobs to help the family meet the expenses of living in the very costly capital. Mary worked in the land office and Vinny worked for the post office.
By all accounts, Vinny had been interested in the arts from a very young age. They'd lived in these various frontier areas while her father mapped them out for development, and that had not offered a lot of opportunity to really be able to engage with art and education, especially not at the level she really craved. She did, for a little while, attend the Art Academy of the Christian College of Columbia, Missouri. She had also started playing music when the family lived in Kansas and her father bought a guitar. She taught herself how to play from a songbook and soon started teaching other people how to do that. So once they were in Washington, D.C., she used some of the money she made to take language and music lessons. And eventually she got an invite from Missouri Representative James S. Rollins, who was a friend of the family from their time back in Missouri. And that would really change her life. Rollins was sitting for a bust with sculptor Clark Mills, and he invited Vinny to come with him to one of his sessions.
Mills was a self-taught sculptor who had gained fame for his work depicting Andrew Jackson riding a horse for Lafayette Square in Washington, D.C. That was unveiled in 1853. That sculpture is notable from an artistic standpoint because when Mills created it, he had never met or even seen Andrew Jackson in person. He had also never seen an equestrian statue, and his resulting work, which features the horse rearing up slightly so that it's supported only by its back legs, was considered pretty revolutionary at the time. Later on, people started to criticize it for being overly showy, but at the time, they were like, wow! When that statue was unveiled, Mills made this point of reaching up and grabbing the forelegs that were off the ground and pulling himself up as a show of the work's strength and its balance. If you have ever been to Jackson Square in New Orleans, that statue that's there of Andrew Jackson is the same one. It was cast a second time by Mills. And all of this accomplishment on his part as a sculptor sounds really grand, but we have to note that it is not really the work of Mills exclusively. It is very well known and very well documented that a master craftsman named Philip Reed deserves a lot of the credit. Reed was an enslaved man that Mills had purchased while living in South Carolina, and Reed was highly skilled in metallurgical casting, and he very well may be a future episode, but I feel like not giving him any credit here would be wrong.
In 1863, when Reem found herself in Mills' studio, Mills was finishing up his sculpture, Liberty. That was in addition to the busts he was making of various politicians. Reem was enthralled with the work that he was doing, and Mills is said to have given her a piece of clay to work with while he tended to Rollins and his sitting. He also gave her a bust of a Native American chief to use as her model. While these two men worked, she produced a medallion that featured this chief in profile, and Mills was apparently so impressed with this that he wanted to take her on as an apprentice. She kept working at the post office, but her new tutor and her boss worked out a schedule so that she could do both of them.
Yeah, she definitely, as you'll see as we go on, modeled her entire career on the way Mills operated, where he would have like one big commission going on and then taking a whole lot of smaller ones at the same time. Because Mills had both a sculpting studio and a foundry, Reem was able to get a really full view of the process of creating sculptures and monuments. She also, as a teenager approaching adulthood, started to think about her future. Taking inspiration from the small group of women sculptors who had started to be recognized as professional artists, including previous podcast subject Edmonia Lewis, Vinny really started to see that as a path for herself. And she seemed to understand that she would need the help of a lot of people in power, specifically men, to be able to live an independent life as an artist. Being in Washington, D.C., Reem turned her hand to sculpting the politicians of the city, and she used a lot of her connections to grow her network and curry favor when she could.
Using these connections in 1864, Reem was given the honor of sculpting President Abraham Lincoln from life. This took some work on her part. She's said to have gotten several members of Congress to approach the president with this request, and although he was initially reluctant, he did agree. Some accounts suggest that Lincoln was swayed by the fact that Reem was from a humble background and had, like him, lived on the frontier.
From 1864 to 1865, she created the Lincoln bust. Their sittings together were 30 minutes at a time. The actual number is not entirely clear to me. I read the differing accounts, but it's about half a dozen. And Rehm later reported that the president rarely spoke during these meetings. He didn't sit still the way you might imagine someone sitting for a painting, though. He tended to walk around the office and tend to his business. She also described him as very sorrowful during these meetings. His son Will had died 2 years prior, and that even sometimes he would cry. And whether any of this is true, we just don't know because she gave these accounts after his death and he never commented on their meetings.
What we do know is that having Lincoln sit for her immediately put Vinnie Rehm in very high demand. It seems like everyone in Washington wanted to sit for this young artist who had sculpted the president. Soon she had commissions from a lot of the city's politicians. Just as Rehm was nearing completion of the Lincoln bust, the president was assassinated by John Wilkes Booth.
And while Vinnie Rehm described reeling from the news that Lincoln had been shot, she was also pretty quick to turn to thoughts of what would happen next. As various memorial committees formed, she knew that some sort of memorial would be commissioned for the president, and she wanted to be the one to receive that commission. She campaigned hard for it, as hard as any politician ever had for office. She wrote to the head of the House Committee on Public Buildings and Grounds, John H. Rice, stating that she knew there would be a call for a life-size marble of Lincoln in the Capitol, and she stated her aim quite plainly, writing, quote, "I respectfully solicit the influence of your committee in favoring me an order for the same, and submit my model bust of Mr. Lincoln as a specimen of my work."
She also pulled off a huge feat in the form of a petition. She had, with help, drafted the body of it herself, and it stated in part, quote, "To whom it may concern, the undersigned members of the Senate and House of Representatives of the Congress of the United States and others being personally acquainted with Miss Vinnie Rehm, take great pleasure in endorsing her claims upon public patronage, no less as a most worthy and accomplished young lady than as possessing rare genius in the beautiful art of sculpture." The document next lists the various works she's completed, including, of course, her Lincoln bust, and then it concludes with, quote, "As Americans, we should feel a national pride in Miss Rehm and a desire to aid her in the development of her unquestionable genius. Fitly sustained, we feel every confidence that she will excel in her profession and, with age and experience, rank her name with those who have already won high places in America's temple of art."
We're going to talk about this petition some more, the names on it, and the effect it had after we pause for a sponsor break.
I'm Tracy V. Wilson from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Did you know small businesses make up 99.9% of all businesses in the United States? The world is powered by entrepreneurs, and if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks. And every episode, hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres talk to entrepreneurs about how they've grown from the lessons of launching and nurturing a small business, and how they have found success being their own boss. From the excitement of first starting out to finding the right tools and resources to process invoices and payments like QuickBooks Money, you won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too. And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks.
Today I'm going to give you some straightforward advice on how to deal with naughty kids. How about instead of timeouts, time ins? Time for you to start paying some bills. I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward, inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a Gagillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
Planning your next trip? Choice Hotels has a stay for any traveler you want to be with 22 brands and over 7,400 locations. Whether you're a business traveler, a family road tripper, someone who wants to seek out history and maybe make your own, or just planning a quick getaway, Choice Hotels has a stay for any you. Like a Cambria Hotel, where you can be a cocktail connoisseur and sip locally inspired craft beverages at downtown locations in the center of it all. This is a fun way to visit cities with a lot of history and a lot of fun in mind. Or a Radisson Hotel, for all our productivity powerhouses out there. With flexible workspaces and on-site restaurants, you'll get the most out of your work trip. You'll get the coffee, the Wi-Fi, and the work done. And we can't forget about Comfort Hotels. Imagine you're a family road tripper waking up in your big spacious room and then heading down to a free hot breakfast for the entire family, including waffles. So you'll be well-fed and ready for the day's adventure, even if that's just relaxing. After that, you're spending all afternoon relaxing by the pool. You deserve it. What are you waiting for? Join Choice Privileges and start earning points toward your next stay. Find a stay for any you. Book directly at choicehotels.com, where travels come true. The truly astonishing part of Vinnie Rehm's petition to be considered for the Lincoln Sculpture Commission was the list of people who signed it. 31 senators and 110 members of the House of Representatives put their names to it. But more impressively, so did Schuyler Colfax, Speaker of the House, Henry Stanberry, Attorney General, O.H. Browning, Secretary of the Interior, Hugh McCulloch, Secretary of the Treasury, J.W. Barnes, the Surgeon General, Ulysses S. Grant, General of the Union Army, and Andrew Johnson, the President. Vinnie had made the rounds of people she had connections with in D.C., and she had gotten them to sign. And then she worked with John H. Rice to craft a bill to be introduced into the House, suggesting Rehm as the sculptor to whom the inevitable commission should go. She also sent gifts to congressmen, things like small sculptures and flowers, and she asked the politicians she had become closest to for their aid in lobbying with their colleagues.
Rice introduced the topic to the House on July 26, 1866, and although there were criticisms, mainly that she was very young and not up to the task, it passed a vote by a landslide. California Senator John Conness had agreed to introduce this bill to the Senate. It didn't go as well there. In that instance, the arguments against Rehm were led by Charles Sumner of Massachusetts. He had turned down the request to sign Rehm's petition, and he felt that she was too inexperienced. He also introduced the information that Mary Todd Lincoln, who he was very good friends with, agreed with him.
As Vinnie watched from the gallery, she saw this bill argued and become a matter that was argued for its merits of having even been introduced. The Senate was in the midst of looking at issues like war widows and veterans' pensions, so this just did not seem as important, and some people were angry it had even been brought in to begin with. When a vote was called as to whether or not the Senate should take up the resolution, it did pass, though. That meant that debate could begin in earnest, and as Vinnie looked on, a bunch of senators argued about her merits.
Sumner opened his arguments by saying it was a gamble to give such a large sum of money to an untested artist. He was known for his taste and knowledge of art, and he spoke at length about the many pieces of art that were installed in federal buildings and where they'd come from. He pointed out all the established careers of the contributors. He also compared the situation to giving Rehm a position alongside General Grant in combat. She just wasn't prepared for it. He closed by noting that the politicians who wanted to support her career could do so with gifts or grants, but that it was not really a wise investment to put so much faith and finance behind somebody with her experience level for such an important project. This was a long speech, and at several points he made it seem as though he had been forced to say such unkind things, noting, quote, "I am pained to be constrained to say what I do, but when you press this to a vote, you leave me no alternative. Admit that she may make a statue. She cannot make one that you will be justified in placing in this national capital. Promise is not performance, but what she has done thus far comes under the first head rather than the latter. Surely this edifice, so beautiful and interesting, should not be opened to the experiments of untried talent. Only the finished artists should be invited to its ornamentation.
But Rheem had, as that petition suggested, a lot of supporters, and they were ready to just as vehemently defend her as Sumner had been to argue against her. Senator James Nesmith noted that Sumner seemed to be constantly pointing to European artists as being more appropriate for such a commission rather than considering an artist from the U.S. He once again reiterated how good the busts she had already created were. James Dougal of California also spoke on her behalf, specifically arguing that calling it charity to commission her was absolutely inaccurate. Richard Yates of Illinois also stood in support of her. It seemed for a moment like Sumner was really the only senator against the commission.
But then Michigan Senator Jacob Merritt Howard spoke. He was very conservative and was not at all in favor of Rheem getting $10,000 to make a statue when she had never done anything quite like it before. He stated, quote, "She has shown no lack of that particular talent known as lobbying in pressing forward her enterprise. I have seen her models of Mr. Lincoln. I have seen and examined the one especially to which reference is most frequently had. And although I do not pretend to be a connoisseur in this kind of art, I am prepared to say that I never was satisfied with that model." He goes on to describe the Lincoln bust as, quote, "monotonous and without meaning and without spirit." But he then got really mean and openly sexist about it, saying, quote, "Having in view the youth and inexperience of Miss Rheem, and I will go further and say, having in view her sex, I shall expect a complete failure in the execution of this work. I would as soon think of a lady writing the Iliad of Homer. I should as soon think of placing at the head of an army a woman for the conduct of a great campaign." This started a side argument with Pennsylvania Senator Edgar Cowan, who wasn't exactly a supporter of Venny, but he thought Howard had gone too far, and he pointed out that history showed women doing exactly the kinds of things that the Michigan senator just found unfathomable. Senator McDougal also joined this argument and, in a move, was sort of humorous to Holly in research, invoked Sappho on the Senate floor as evidence of the capability of women.
This to me just, it tickled me utterly. Like, have you read Sappho? Like, and then arguing about Sappho. They were just really, really wadded up about this whole thing. And as this argument continued, the idea of an amendment to the bill was suggested as a sort of compromise. Like, what if some senators thought they added a stipulation that Rheem only would receive the full payment if she delivered the statue as promised? She would, per the terms of this bill, be paid $5,000 up front and then the remainder when the work was delivered. So some senators thought they should add a provision that the final payment also had to be approved by the Secretary of the Interior after the work was inspected for quality. This set off another round of debate, with Vinnie's supporters pointing out that if she did the work, she should get paid full stop. It shouldn't be on this contingent that, like, everybody approved it. After all the bickering, the bill went to vote.
When the vote happened, late July 27th, 1866, Congress commissioned a full-size statue of Lincoln from Rheem. And there's an interesting aspect to the way the vote split. Quite a few senators changed sides before it was over. Edgar Cowan, for example, had not initially been in favor of Rheem for a commission, but then stated, quote, "I have come to the conclusion to vote for this resolution. And I have come to the conclusion that this young lady, whoever she may be, is unquestionably a person of great genius. It may not be exactly in the line of sculpture, but certainly she is that in agitation. She is occupying the talents of all the senators and has shaken this chamber to its very center. Certainly, it is no ordinary girl who can do this." And some of her early supporters, even some who had signed her petition, then reconsidered and voted against the bill after having been persuaded by Senator Sumner's lengthy arguments on the matter. But it passed, and this made her the first woman to receive a federal art commission.
But though things were settled in terms of the congressional resolution, this commission was also controversial in the court of public opinion. Because Vinnie Rehm had been Clark Mills's apprentice in his studio at the Capitol, she met a lot of politicians. And this was a very unique scenario. She had also been working as a teenager alongside an adult man, which was unusual and carried some stigma. And this set of circumstances meant that she was able to make the acquaintances of numerous men without a family chaperone involved. She was also very pretty and lively and very well liked. As the commission and the debate about it became news in Washington and then hit the national papers, people started to form opinions about how things played out that involved a lot of speculation about Vinnie Rehm and her behavior.
The Hartford Courant and a lot of other papers ran an article from a Washington correspondent on August 7th, 1866, and it read, quote, "The discussion in the Senate on the bill to give a young woman by the name of Vinnie Rehm a commission to make a full-length, life-size statue of Mr. Lincoln for the sum of $10,000 was very interesting and is a singular illustration of the way in which the public money is wasted. But who is Vinnie Rehm? No one that I have met knows much about her, and I presume there is little to know. She has been here all winter, working with a woman's persistent energy to enlist in her favor everybody who seemed at all likely to help her in getting this appropriation passed." While it's not explicitly spelled out here, the implication was that Vinnie Rehm was doing something morally wrong because she was an attractive young woman. Rumors started to swirl that she had used her feminine charms in some way to gain the favor of all these politicians who then supported her for the commission.
The Portland Daily Press ran a brief mention of Rehm on August 15, 1866, which simply read, quote, "Vinnie Rehm, to whom Congress has voted $10,000 for a statue of Lincoln, is a rather handsome young woman who has extraordinary powers of persuasion through lobby appliances. So far as known, she has never accomplished a single work of art which will stand criticism."
For months, there continued to be negative press about Rehm, a lot of it insinuating that she had done something inappropriate to gain the favor of so many representatives. In the Leavenworth Times of Leavenworth, Kansas, a commentary piece ran on September 6th under the headline, "A Homely Woman's Opinion of a Pretty One." That has its own problems right there, although it was intended as an insult to the woman sharing her opinion as follows, quote, "Miss Swisselm says of Miss Vinnie Rehm, who received the $10,000 order for the Lincoln statue, she is a young girl about 20, has only been studying her art a few months, never made a statue, has made some plaster busts on exhibit at the Capitol, including her own, minus clothing to the waist, has a pretty face, long dark curls and plenty of them, wears a jockey hat and a good deal of jewelry, sees all the members at their lodgings or the reception room in the Capitol, urges her claims fluently and confidently, sits in the galleries in a conspicuous position in her most bewitching dress while those claims are being discussed on the floor, and nods and smiles as a member rises and delivers his opinion of the merits of the case with the air of a man sitting for his picture. And so she carries the day over Powers and Crawford and Homer and who not."
It is clear from this quote that people were willing to minimize Vinnie's actual art experience and accomplishment in favor of characterizing her as a woman who beguiles men to get what she wants. And there was a lot of gossip that during the Senate debate on the commission, she was flirting from the gallery with various senators below and winking and waving while wearing, as this write-up mentions, some sort of alluring attire. But there's no actual evidence of any of that, and there's really no way to know. Also, that bare-chested bust that's referenced in the above quote was not a self-portrait. This is apparently something that really upset Vinnie Rehm. That was a bust titled Violet, which features a woman that doesn't look like her at all, in a very romantic style, with flowers encircling her torso just below her bare breasts. And it's very much, if you look at it, in line with a lot of classical art you would see.
And just as Senator Sumner and others had worried, the press also voiced concern that this project was just too important to put in the hands of a relatively unknown artist. The Chicago Tribune noted of Rehm on October 21st, quote, "Who is Miss Vinnie Rehm? Was she ever heard of before? What rank does she hold in the artist world? Has she ever had experience chiseling statues? In regard to the first two questions, there seems to be a cloud of mystery overhanging her. We have never yet met a person of sufficient temerity to answer them. We regret because she is a lady that she has manifested a spirit which is utterly impossible in a true artist. We regret that so important a work should have been carelessly entrusted to inexperienced and unknown hands. No public man has ever been so miserably caricatured by bunglers as Mr. Lincoln, and we shudder at the possibility that the halls of Congress must endure another.
Perhaps the trickiest part in sorting all of this out is that there definitely were politicians who were interested in Vinnie Ream romantically. It has been stated several times that she was a charmer, but she seems to be a little bit offhand about those interests. She was still a teenager at this time, remember, moving in the corridors of power. And while she's often characterized for her savvy in dealing with men in power, we really don't know if she was being calculating or maybe just overly friendly for the mores of the time, and some men took it the wrong way. She did, to be clear, receive love letters from all kinds of men, including people like General Custer and William Tecumseh Sherman. So there's no way she was ignorant that she was very appealing to men, but it's also impossible to know if she was, as she was often accused, conniving in her dealings with them, or to what degree. It's also possible she was flirty and not a mastermind. We don't really know.
If you want to hear more specifically about the congressional debate about Ream, you can check out the podcast Shaping History, Women in Capital Art, which was produced by the U.S. Capitol Visitors Center. The episode they did on Ream delves into the expectations of women culturally during this time and how Vinnie Ream navigated that landscape.
Now, coming up, we're going to talk about how Mary Todd Lincoln felt about Vinnie Ream. Spoiler alert, not great. We will get into the details of it, though, and whew, it's a doozy after we hear from the sponsors that keep the show going.
I'm Tracy V. Wilson from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Did you know small businesses make up 99.9% of all businesses in the United States? The world is powered by entrepreneurs, and if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks. And every episode, hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres talk to entrepreneurs about how they've grown from the lessons of launching and nurturing a small business, and how they have found success being their own boss. From the excitement of first starting out to finding the right tools and resources to process invoices and payments like QuickBooks Money, you won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too. And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks.
Today I'm going to give you some straightforward advice on how to deal with naughty kids. How about instead of timeouts, time ins? Time for you to start paying some bills. I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward, inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
Planning your next trip? Choice Hotels has a stay for any traveler you want to be, with 22 brands and over 7,400 locations. Whether you're a business traveler, a family road tripper, someone who wants to seek out history and maybe make your own, or just planning a quick getaway, Choice Hotels has a stay for any you. Like a Cambria Hotel, where you can be a cocktail connoisseur and sip locally inspired craft beverages at downtown locations in the center of it all. This is a fun way to visit cities with a lot of history and a lot of fun in mind. Or a Radisson Hotel for for all our productivity powerhouses out there. With flexible workspaces and on-site restaurants, you'll get the most out of your work trip. You'll get the coffee, the Wi-Fi, and the work done. And we can't forget about comfort hotels. Imagine you're a family road trip or waking up in your big spacious room and then heading down to a free hot breakfast for the entire family, including waffles. So you'll be well-fed and ready for the day's adventure, even if that's just relaxing. After that, you're spending all afternoon relaxing by the pool. You deserve it. What are you waiting for? Join Choice Privileges and start earning points toward your next stay. Find a stay for any you. Book directly at choicehotels.com, where travels come true. Even as Vinny signed her contract and started her project, she came up against resistance. And one particular roadblock to the project was Mary Todd Lincoln. After Vinny was introduced by letter to Mrs. Lincoln by one of her supporters in the Senate, the artist wrote her own letter to the former First Lady, requesting her assistance on direction of the statue. What she got in return was a letter that is a masterclass in passive-aggressive politeness. Mrs. Lincoln wrote in part, quote, "I shall be unable to comply with your request, and you will allow me to say you are undertaking a very sacred work, one of great responsibility, which artists of worldwide renown would shrink from as incapable of the great task. As every friend my husband knew was familiar to me, and as your name was not on the list, consequently, you could not have become familiar with the expression of his face, which was so variable. I cannot fix my distressed mind on any particular look, hence the difficulty of the task for you, a stranger to this great, good, and Christ-like man. Praying that you have success, I remain truly Mary Todd Lincoln." I like that she's not truly yours, truly kind. I just remain Mary Todd Lincoln. Mrs. Lincoln also wrote to Senator Sumner that Vinnie's work was sure to be a, quote, "mortifying failure." And also, to jump back a bit to the last segment, that Miss Swissell mentioned in the newspaper write-up that Tracy quoted, that was Jane Grey Swissell, and she was Mary Todd Lincoln's BFF from the time they were kids.
Then, when Vinny tried to find the president's suit from the day he had died so that she could model it for the statue, she ended up making a request to Alphonse Dunn, who was the White House doorman. He had been given the suit as a show of thanks for his service, and Mary Todd Lincoln interceded with this request. She wrote to Dunn that he should not let Vinny Ream borrow the suit. Mrs. Lincoln knew that she was being really petty in all this because she concluded this letter to Dunn pretty frantically with, quote, "Let me hear from you on this subject when you receive this letter, and show this letter to no one. Only burn it. I feel as I gave them to you, I can dictate a little about them. Write on receipt of this. What you say will not be mentioned. Use your own discretion about lending the clothes, but as they are a gift from me, you are under no obligation to yield them into other hands. All this you will understand. I do not wish my name mentioned in it. Write me all about it. Burn this and mention contents to no one." Once again, congressmen got involved. All of Ream's network was trying to just smooth all of this over. And that seems to have worked because Mrs. Lincoln then wrote to Dunn again 3 weeks later and told him he could loan out the suit and that she really hoped that Vinny Ream succeeded in her endeavor. But she also got in another instance of saying that she did not know Ream and thought she was very inexperienced. Still, though, at this point, the matter was resolved and Vinny got to use these clothes.
That whole, like, burn this, she's horrible, I hate her, burn this.
Don't tell anybody I said this and also burn it.
Do not mention my name, but you got to burn this letter, which he obviously did not because the letter exists.
Right.
As press commentary and speculation about her continued, Ream got to work. She had been granted a studio space in the Capitol, which required some updates before she was pleased with it for working. And once it was ready, she essentially had the studio open, and people could stop in almost any time and watch her work. She worked very long hours, from early in the morning to as late as 11 p.m. on a lot of days. And as more and more people visited her studio, they were actually pretty charmed and impressed by her. And this resulted in a little bit more positive press than before the project started, although there was still plenty of negative. But the studio became like the it spot for visitors to the Capitol. A lot of the things I read suggested it became Washington, D.C.'s biggest tourist destination. Everyone from war veterans to Supreme Court justices to Lincoln's son, Robert Todd Lincoln, came to visit at one point or another. And often they would linger and socialize while watching the artist at work. Later, Vinnie described the studio's crowds this way, quote, "Friend and foe gathered with a common interest, the success of the work. Old feuds were forgotten and they were met on neutral ground. Some on friendly terms who had not spoken to each other for years. I was generally a silent listener as the men conversed, but what they said made deep impression, for ever on their lips was the name of Lincoln." And throughout all of this, Vinnie wasn't only working exclusively on the Lincoln model. She was also, as her mentor Clark Mills had done, taking other commissions to keep steady cash flow. So her studio was a very, very busy place.
Even as Rame's Lincoln model was nearing completion in the summer of 1868, there was yet more controversy. She'd made the head in clay and then cast it in plaster, and then used the plaster cast atop the body, which was sculpted in clay supported by iron rods. This model would then be recreated in marble for the final statue. Because the model was being shown for viewings before this marble version was made, paint was used to match the clay and plaster sections. A lack of understanding about this process led people to accusing Rame of fakery, suggesting that this work was not her own. This rumor persisted enough that Rame had handbills printed for distribution throughout the Capitol that read, quote, "Sir, I understand that my model for the Lincoln statue is being criticized for the reason that the head is in plaster instead of clay, like the body of the model. It is true that the head is in plaster, but it is also true that the model was first made in clay, as is the practice of sculptors usually, and it is entirely the work of my own hands, upon which I labored for many months. A plaster facsimile was then taken and since placed upon the clay model for the reason that in plaster it was much less liable to be injured by the daily moistening which the clay model requires. It was painted its present color simply to make it correspond with the balance of the figure. It should be remembered that very many eminent sculptors often model in plaster instead of clay, and even had I done so in this instance, it would have been perfectly legitimate and should not be made the ground of criticism against my work. The head of this model is a perfect copy of the one made by me, being selected by them as the most truthful likeness of Mr. Lincoln they could procure. Very respectfully, Vinnie Rame."
In January 1869, the statue, the model for the statue, was formally displayed for viewing. And papers ran stories that said that the work was a perfect recreation of Lincoln, but also that it was not great art. There was, of course, another debate in the Senate about whether she should get her second $5,000. Once again, Senator Sumner spoke out against it, but when he was questioned as to whether he had even seen the model, Sumner confessed that he hadn't, saying, quote, "I criticize it on what I have heard and read about it." Ultimately, the statue was approved, but even so, the money would take some time to be disbursed, and a lot of that money was actually going to go towards the marble reproduction. It was not as though Rame was rolling in money from this entire work. That $10,000, which was a lot of money at the time, was for a fully executed sculpture, but she had to pay for all the materials and live off of what was left. So she wasn't a starving artist by any means, but though that price tag was very hefty at the time, it didn't set the artist up for life. She was going to have to contract someone to recreate it in marble.
The next step was for 22-year-old Vinnie Rame to take her model to Italy so that it could be made in marble. And we will get into that and the rest of her life next time.
And if any of you know a lot about Vinnie Rame and you're like, there's another scandal you haven't mentioned, it's coming in part two. I just had to break it up. There's so many scandals. And the next one is also so juicy that it just wouldn't fit. I have listener mail that has nothing to do with scandal or, you know, drama, unless you find bird things dramatic.
All right.
Which some people do. This is from our listener, Kirsten, who's, or maybe she says Kirsten, I don't know, so apologies if I got it wrong, and writes, "Hi, Holly and Tracy, I love your podcast and was excited about Holly's recent request for corvid photos. Here are a couple of beautiful Australian magpies begging me at a cafe in Sydney's Taronga Zoo just yesterday. Unfortunately, they could not have any of my beer or chocolate ice cream. I am completing a trip to my 59th and 60th countries visited, New Zealand and Australia. I highly recommend visiting these countries for anyone who enjoys seeing unique birds." Well, they just went higher on my list. Fun fact, Australian magpies are actually not related to other magpies and are technically not corvids, but after your request, I felt they were too beautiful not to share. Thank you for your wonderful work. It makes the world a better place. This is Kirsten, who went on the Barcelona trip with us, and I can't remember how she pronounced it, and I feel bad. But I love some again, these aren't technically corvids, but these magpies are beautiful because they look
are.
Almost like they have the piebald coloring mm-hmm. that's like chunks of white with chunks of black, which I love. Which, by the way, some corvids do have that coloring. They are not all black. But I'm here for it. I want all of the bird colors. I want all the bird pictures.
We saw some magpies in Barcelona.
Mm-hmm.
I'm imagining probably different birds than the ones in these pictures, which I don't have pulled up because that's a different place. But I had not ever made the connection of what magpies actually looked like. And I had kind of made a picture of them in my head that looked like a crow or a raven or something similar. And they don't look like that at all.
Mm-mm. I mean, insofar as they have two legs and two wings and a beak.
Yeah, but they're different. They're shaped and colored differently.
Yes, they are. Listen, there are always lots of discussions about what birds are what, especially if you get into corvids, right? Like a lot of people
mm-hmm.
think that crows are ravens and ravens are crows. That's not true. Ravens are much bigger. This got to be a big debate in my life because I still believe in my heart, we had last year one weird raven that was visiting us.
Yeah.
This is not normal territory for a raven, which is why it was weird. And he was like, he looked like a very old dude and his ruff around his neck was very gray. And he just had this great grizzled look about him.
Mm-hmm.
And we used to call him Baron Afanas, which if you watch What We Do in the Shadows, you will understand. But
that is great.
But most of the time, the ones you see running around, at least in our area of the country, are indeed crows.
Yeah. Rosemary Mosco made like a How to Tell a Raven from a Crow webcomic. And what, like, even with that, they're still pretty similar.
Yeah, it can be like, tricky. Ravens are usually, most people, like, the joke is, if you're not sure, it's probably a crow. If you're like, holy crap, that's huge, it's a raven.
Yeah. And that's, of course, in the United States. Other places might have different proportions.
Differ for sure. The ruff is usually what I look for. Like, ravens tend to have that fluffy bit of feathering right under their head and around their neck that makes them look a little more distinctive. But sometimes those sit closer to their bodies depending on the bird. Anyway, you didn't come here for bird talk, you came here for history. But here you got some bird talk as a bonus. If you would like to write to us about your bird theories, your bird pictures, whatever you wish, you can do that at historypodcast@iheartradio.com. You can also find us on social media as Missed in History. And if you have not subscribed yet, but you would like to, that is the easiest thing on earth to do. You just do it on your iHeartRadio app or wherever you're listening to your favorite shows.
Stuff You Missed in History Class is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
This is it. We've got an Amex Platinum Pro on our hands, ladies and gentlemen. We haven't seen anyone relax like this before in the Centurion Lounge. Is he connecting to complimentary Wi-Fi? Oh, my. Look at that. He is. And you will not believe where he's going next. The Amex dedicated card member entrance for the win. Unbelievable.
When you get travel perks with Amex Platinum, you're part of the action. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/withAmex.